The following is a recording of a question and answer period that took place at the conclusion of the September 14th meeting in Belfast, Maine, of the Interagency Task Force on Ocean Wind off of the state of Maine. The 24-minute session consists of questions asked by Penobscot Baywatch activist Ron Huber and answered by Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, Regulation and Enforcement Chief Maureen Bornholt.
Welcome to the question and answer session. I will put our friends from the state on notice that there may be questions from the public directed your way, so be prepared.
Oh, there they are. Okay. All right.
All right, and we are going to have just a little bit of time for this, probably 45 minutes. I think that is most definitely long enough to get through the laundry list we have over here. Why don't you go ahead and start with your first one?
Well, sure. My first question, it was sort of touched on, but was mentioned by Beth Noguski, the state legislature looked at promoting wind power 10 miles offshore here and in deep waters, and yet that particular standard may not be one that Burma is considering. Is the idea to basically respect a state's legislative decision that they don't want wind power within most federal waters? How does that jive with your basically purposes here?
I think probably one of the lessons learned from all of our oceans, my ocean energy experience with oil and gas and sand and gravel, is if you move in an area that you don't have support from the state at the outset, it becomes more investment in trying to argue and get together than it does to be able to move forward and actually use resources efficiently to move forward to a common goal. And so if the state has made a determination that it rather look at 10 miles off the coast or look at a particular sector, whether it's deep water, whatever have you, we want to partner with that effort so we can actualize real projects. We don't want to spend our time, debating with the state, well, let's go closer to 3 miles. So we're looking for, our common goal, I think, is to be able to develop renewable energy in a collaborative fashion. And so that means you start to get good.
Collaborate with the way that the state is trying to shape things then.
We still are challenged as a federal government by certain federal statutes. And we're not going to allow murder on these facilities.
Right.
The state doesn't want that either. So we just have to make sure that we are able to meet our, statutory obligations in consideration of issues such as let's start from 10 miles out.
Okay. And are other standards, I guess just to sort of round off that question there, one of the centers they've been promoting here in Maine have been floating windmills, anchored but floating, and not as in, I don't know what you call the Cape Wind ones, anchored or just
monopoles.
So is that going to be another area that you somehow have to find some sort of an either-or thing at this point, as far as I understand it?
That's an either-or thing. I think that somebody mentioned around the table about, I think it was Matt was talking about water depths and certain technologies. In order for you to use the monopiles in, 30 meters of water, that's something that probably isn't the best use of that technology for that area. So I think what you're going to see are environmental conditions and economics come into play as the types of technology that is developed and that can be best used. And so that's not an area we're going to sit and argue about, because I think the bottom line is we'll take a look at technology with regard to engineering requirements for safety and see how that matches the environment that they're being placed in.
Okay. And what was other? Okay. Now, a few years ago, the state decided to throw in with Washington State on requiring certain standards for oil tankers, and then there was a case brought to the U.S. Supreme Court, and it was thrown out that basically saying that the interests of the federal government can override those of the state when it comes to interstate commerce and things. So, I guess it was sort of tied to this other one. If the state has certain standards, can they be? And I don't know whether the next meeting will tell us more about that. Can they be overridden within this system if we go, well, the developer really thinks that this would be great, 6 miles from shore there in a nice shallow spot. It's not fished very much or something. and the state says no, no, no. How does that sort of thing get resolved, if indeed it ever came up?
Well, because that's what we have, the folks that we have around the table. You know, obviously, at the end of the day, it's our secretary that makes the decision.
Mm.
And so, you know, that said, I think it's in, I know for me, the best interest of our agency, if we can report to him what are the issues and concerns, how have we worked out areas that we know that are possible for collaboration. Maybe we compromise. We don't compromise on certain things, of course, like safety and things like that.
Yeah.
So to me, just to be have the dogma of our way or no way, I'm not going to promote that kind of option to my secretary because it's not going to fly there.
Mm.
And so to me, if it becomes an issue associated with engineering standards and safety, I think we can have that honest dialogue around the table so that if we have to make a decision that perhaps is not one the state or another entity is really a proponent of, at least they'll understand why we made that decision and that they've had the opportunity to inform us
mm-hmm.
and to hear us and we hear them. I think that's the key thing, again, is that collaborative process. So at the end of the day, when the decision and the options go to the secretary, everybody understands why certain recommendations are being made, why we deferred certain areas from using,
mm-hmm.
why we focus certain areas.
And being a real world, everyone will be sacrificing a bit if necessary.
Isn't that what compromise?
Yeah, that's right. Are you contemplating any majorly different management for floating versus the monopoles? I mean, the important point to me is that, you know, the monopoles are much more difficult to move if you decide, well, this wasn't the greatest place, whereas, in theory at least, the state's plan will have a certain mobility to it. And yet it seems like there ought to be an entirely different set of requirements and things in this.
Well, I think that's why we call it a regulatory framework. Mm-hmm. We haven't prescribed standards within the regulatory framework because what we want to do is let me take a step back. We knew that we would be authorizing many different types of renewable energy activities.
Mm-hmm.
We knew that it could be marine hydrokinetics, ocean wave, ocean current. And when you can take a look at those two types, there are so many different types of machines and technologies within that. And so we decided, you know, we don't know enough about what could be developed, as well as looking at some of these technologies that haven't been fully formed or vetted to be able to have a prescriptive
mm-hmm.
sort of regulatory
yeah.
framework. So now back to your question. So we do have the ability to take a look at each project and evaluate it for what it is. So a situation using monopiles versus floating versus gravity-based, we take that same filter or frame and evaluate the project. Different standards, absolutely. We
mm-hmm.
come up moorings versus, you know, perhaps
right.
a base that has concrete and whatnot holding down its gravity base system. So we won't treat them all alike, but we'll look at them through the same kind of analytics.
Okay. Now, one thing I wonder about coordinating states' data, I know that Matt there talked about his particular program he'd be using, and I'm supposing that there's the multi-purpose marine cadastre. Are you going to try to integrate things from? Because I assume that the folks down in Massachusetts may not be using the same system as Maine and so on. And, you know, when you have data incongruities, you're going to have some way of sort of mixing them all together.
With all those challenges. What happened in the Energy Policy Act in 2005 that gave us the authority to leave the Outer Continental Shelf for renewables
mm-hmm.
also told the Secretary of the Interior that the department must develop this tool. And it was multi-purpose marine kit. No, it's not what they call it. They call it a marine mapping initiative. I think that's the law said. And so we had this marine cadastre because when we do leasing, we have the real estate and the legal lines embedded in a database system. So we said, okay, Congress told us we must do this marine mapping initiative to help inform the public and other feds, et cetera, about leasing for renewables. But we knew it had more utility in not just leasing for renewables.
Mm-hmm.
And so the concept behind our multi-purpose marine cadastre isn't to house the specific data on a server, but Matt used the word portal, and it's exactly that, to be a portal to all this connectivity. So to the extent that we can have a working agreement with, well, We do have an agreement with Rhode Island for their special area management plan data. We will have access through our multi-purpose marine disaster to be able to call up that data and use it. So I think there's some massaging that has to be taking place, but it's not as much as if we house the data on our own.
I see. And then you might tend to rely on that Rhode Island data in offshore waters just off of Rhode Island, et cetera, since that's what they'd be using there. Okay. Huh. Now, back in the old MMS days, there's quite a bit of exploration and work on George's Bank and, in the Gulf of Maine as well, you know, before the CLF lawsuits and all that. Is that data going to be entered in also to some extent? I mean,
well, it's funny because Tanara was just having this conversation the other day after the Massachusetts meeting, and we knew that there were geophysical and geologic data that was collected during those times to try to find out, you know, where is it being housed now and is it useful, because technology has evolved in collecting that type of data. Yes, 3D data, I think these are paper, you know, data. So we're trying to find out where that went and is it useful for some of these purposes, because it may be, or it may be so outmoded by the new technology.
Right, get a much more sensitive picture or something. But you're basically, and I wondered that because there's this, there was a book that the state of Maine put out. It's called Fishing Grounds of the Gulf of Maine from 1929, but it listed all the, about 300 fishing grounds that are off the coast of the Gulf of Maine, the U.S., and some further out, you know, George's and a few other further banks. But in each of them, they gave a description of the geography, the, you know, the geology, the fish that in that sort of pre-dragger era that would be seasonally there and so on. Now that's, it's more backup data, but I assume the more info you get that's been reviewed, I mean, this is from a U.S. Fish Commission.
That's the thing we were talking about, granularity. And it depends on where you are in the process and the type of information that you need. I think that information like this helps serve as baseline. And so when you talk about maybe a leasing action that encompasses a broad area, that helps inform that. But when you start honing down to maybe six OCS blocks, and an OCS block is about 3 miles by 3 miles, for a specific project proposal, you're really going to need detailed information. That's usually the challenge in getting that information.
I see.
But even in this effort that I encourage people to bring their data, that kind of data is useful because you can take a look. It doesn't matter if it's 1929 or 2009. If it gives you a sense of what the geology is, what the benthic habitat is, it gives you that clue as to is this going to be compatible, or is this a place where it has those huge moraines that go granite rocks that I know Rhode Island tried to avoid because they knew that for driving piles, that becomes a challenge. And so it helps inform. It may not help inform in the micro situation of the project, but it still gives us a sense of what the environment is like.
Okay, because I know I gave this map to a friend who enthusiastically ran out to where this thing from 1929 said there'd be all these haddock, and they weren't there. Doggone it. But the info is there. Okay. I've heard a few times here about this upcoming meeting, the next meeting. That's going to be a very important one, that there may actually be maps, and you'll be asking people to come and look at the maps and start talking physical places there. You've done that in other states. Has there been a lot of resistance among, how has that gone once the rubber hits the road there and you start looking at places?
Well, unfortunately, I missed the second Massachusetts meeting, and not by design. But that was apparently a rather confrontational meeting, because when you start, you know, drawing areas on a map and saying, okay, you know, we think this is going to be good, and then wait a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But through that debate and dialogue, the meeting we just went to last week, we had to have the frank discussion in order to arrive at what we did last week with, oh, there were adjustments made. For example, Massachusetts moved, Jesuit was from 9 miles to 12 miles offshore to address viewshed issues of those areas. And the state initially did not want to move in that direction because they thought, hey, you know, we're missing some opportunities to throw their way and move out transmission costs.
Right.
But I think in having that dialogue and going back, you know, we thought, well, okay, but we might move here, but we still have this. And I think you have to have sometimes those tough dialogue and debate, mm-hmm. and you sit back and digest that, mm-hmm. and then you can make some progress. And the press that came out of that meeting was a surprise. It's one of the first times we've had really positive press from the local perspective saying, hey, they listen to us. And that's really what it is. We're going to have tough conversations in this room as well, and that's fine. I think that developing the working relationships to have those honest and frank, mm-hmm. frank discussions so we can arrive at a place that we know that, hey, for the first area, whether it's responding to an unsolicited proposal or whether it's putting out an area in the public realm to see who's interested, mm-hmm. you got to have those discussions to get to a good spot so you can know that that is going to move forward.
Mm-hmm. Now, Maine's DMR went through something very similar to this with scallop closures. In other words, up and down the entire coast, stretch out maps and go, okay, where do you want to not fish? It has to be a place that has scallops in it. You know, so and at first there was just a map and nobody would go near. And then finally someone from a fishing association said, well, I'll be the jerk, you know, and started. And then people came into it very, very unhappily at first. But is that what you anticipate, that people will come and look at the blank map?
The value of the dialogue. And I think that, I know for me, that I'm very proud of my federal service over 30 years and working environmental issues when it comes to offshore ocean energy development. And so to me, it's sharing some of those things, you know, with the task force that we did that was positive in Santa Gravel. And there were some positive things that we did in all of that. And I think everybody feels that same way. They know their agency. They know where they've been and how they've made tough decisions and the information needed. So I think we'll get that shared. It's going to take some push.
Okay, because
we have an example in Virginia. Let me just talk about that. There's always been this tension between the oil and gas sector and the military, because basically a long time ago, back in the 70s and 80s, we chased them out of the western Gulf of Mexico, so we had land in the eastern Gulf of Mexico. And ever since that occurred, we've really not had a good working relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So here comes renewable energy off of Virginia. Virginia, I mean, Navy installations, that's a big part of the central Virginia economy down there in off of Virginia Beach. And we had two developers with great ideas for renewable energy. And said, oh, yeah, we talked to everybody. We talked to the Navy. We talked to them. We talked to them. And they plopped down their unsolicited proposals in these waters. And when we talked to DOD, there was no way, as proposed, these two facilities or these proposals could even get off the ground. But through that, and having had that conversation with them, we have a great working relationship with them now. We actually have a point of contact in the Secretary of Defense's office that when we work with the state task forces, like in Maine, like in Maryland, we send them the concepts that sit on the task force, we send them the RFI areas, and they go and they gather all the information and vet it hard as to what they think they can live with and what they can't. So we won't have an experience like Virginia. So I think that it's going to take that first maybe uncomfortable situation, and then people will realize the utility is efficient.
Mm-hmm.
And it really helps, you know, us get to the target.
So is that process going to be that the state goes to these different fishing groups with maps, and then since it's going to be, you know, you're trying to limit the activity on this scale to just government officials, are they going to ask the state's folks to go to these and to set up these meetings to have fishermen pound away at these, you know, at the blank maps, and then bring those results in or condensed or something? Or
the state approaches it in a different manner. We can do it as a partnership with education. For instance, in the southern states where the cost of electricity is really, really low, they don't want to jump into state taxes yet. What they've done with us is we've done some education. So, for instance, I think Jess Bradley and two others were down in North Carolina just doing some basic public education to raise the awareness that this may be coming, you know, where your issues and concerns. So every state does it differently. There's no one way that works. I think that, again, you have folks sitting around the table that are very familiar with their stakeholders and their interested public. And so they know best how to approach, whether it's taking a map, attacking it, and meeting hall, and having that kind of discussion, or not. So I think
you want to talk about the map?
Yeah,
what Maryland did is, even before we had an area in mind, state has done kind of their homework. Sort of about 8 months ago, they started a process of they communicated with the fishing communities. They held these public events in Annapolis and in key towns mm-hmm. where they felt that there would be a lot of response and displays and educated the public. Any and everyone was allowed to attend. They answered questions. They had the members of the staff from the state available to talk. We also had Irish representatives in the area.
And so the Watermen's Association, other groups were there to sort of be the perspective of the fishing industry there.
Who was there?
It was the Maryland Watermen's Association. They're kind of like the main.
I don't believe they were there. Yeah. I'm not aware of.
Okay.
There was
a lot of individuals. Oh, okay.
And so, and we'll talk about this probably in the next task force meeting, but what happened in Maryland is there was this huge area that was identified, and because of the information the state had collected, they actually kind of prioritized what they had heard in the sense of, you know, please don't use that area. They're like, well, I think, yeah, we use it for fishing, but
kind of categorized it, but yes, no, maybe.
Okay.
And so what we've done with that is taking that all into consideration, we find down what's eventually going to be out in the public as an area like this instead of an area. Is that for fishing, artificial water corals?
I guess my last question here, and thanks for being for answering these, was the charter. It's the charter that's not a charter or something, right? And I'm wondering. I think I asked somebody. You don't have to get unanimous consent from everybody that was here. When is the charter considered adopted by Maine? Is it just sort of automatically considered that Maine's part of that, or?
I just said that it's kind of like a guiding principle, so it's not looking for the formal. But we will take into consideration people's comments and suggestions, and it could change over time.
Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much what how you guys see it too, then.
Yeah, I would assume we would the entire task force would get a revised draft to look at, and then any further questions within a meeting. So this is a living document, and then guiding principles. We would always have a chance to bring up any issues with regard to that charter.
But there's not a voting situation.
Right.
I think that, like I said, the big bad said at the end of the day, we're the ones that are putting out the RFI based on the comments and the counsel that you've given us, and we're making some of those sorts of decisions. And so we can't delegate that to you. That said, again, lessons learned, to the extent that you can provide a consensus compromise, make the job moving forward just more efficient.
Okay, because you said you can't alter the framework, but can work within the framework. You know, it's just like Maine with its lobster zones. You can fish this many traps or less. You know, you can do a lot of or less things, but there's a standard to meet. Okay. Well, that's pretty much it. I feel very informed. I really appreciate it.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, everyone, for
sharing
your
questions. Thanks.
For more information about this topic and other issues pertaining to the Gulf of Maine and Penobscot Bay, go to the Penobscot Bay blog, penobscotbay.blogspot.com.